right. So I'd first like to thank the organizers for inviting my advisor and allowing me to come instead. So I'm thrilled to be here, and hopefully won't make too much of a fool of myself. But I'm definitely very much in over my head in this conference. I'm really, so far, more qualitative look at sediment transport. And what I'm presenting here is comprises part of my PhD thesis work, of which is only about halfway done. So it's very much a work in progress, and I would love lots of feedback and comments on it all. All right, so the focus of my work is river inflows. And so whenever this can be a general picture of a river coming into a body of water, either a lake or a coastal ocean, river comes in with some momentum it carries with it, which pushes back the stagnant water of the body of water. If the inflow is less dense than the lake water or coastal ocean water, which is more typical, it'll form an overflow. This is what Eckert Myberg showed in his talk, right? We have something that's less dense propagating out over a more dense, perhaps saline fluid. In lakes where we have fresh inflow coming into also fresh water, temperature and sediment concentration can often lead to a more dense inflow. And so what will happen there is we'll have basically a plunge point, at which point the river plunges beneath the surface and propagates along the bottom as an underflow or density current or turbidity current, depending on what body of research you're looking at. These are pretty well studied, right? And then at some point, if the current reaches a point of neutral density in our lake system, this is a very deep lake, and so there's often a background stratification that happens. And so at some point of neutral buoyancy, the current will separate from the bottom and form an intrusion. And if it never reaches that point of neutral density, it'll just continue along as an underflow until the bottom of the lake. And so the depth of this intrusion is quite important for, in our case, we're looking at lakes, because often rivers carry with them sediments, contaminants, and nutrients. Obviously, most importantly for us is sediments, but often things like contaminants tend to absorb onto sediments. So in my case, we're interested in studying DDT transport, which is often associated with sediment transport. Also, things like nutrients, fine organic material, transported into a lake are particularly important as a very shallow intrusion means that those nutrients are immediately available for phytoplankton growth, which can lead to things like harmful algal blooms or eutrophication, whereas a very deep intrusion may mean those don't see any light at all and sort of has no effect on the system. So understanding the depth of this intrusion is pretty important for understanding how the additional things we are adding to the system or affect the ecosystem. Similarly, for our case, a shallow intrusion transports sediment and contaminants much further into the interior of the lake than a deep intrusion where things can settle out pretty quickly. So this is sort of the main picture that we're looking at. Again, so the overall intrusion depth is of importance for understanding how these additions will impact the ecosystem. So that picture is sort of formed after the fact, so I'll kind of go backwards a little bit now. When we first started this field study, we were trying to get a general idea of what was happening in this bay here. So this is a large alpine lake. It's about 45 degrees north latitude, so it's on the border of where rotation is important. It's a relatively deep lake, so in this middle portion, it's about 120 meters deep. The rest of the lake down here is about 300 meters deep. And for scale, this is about 3 to 5 kilometers wide. I know where you're looking. And we weren't really sure what was going to happen. We didn't have too much data on this bay. We kind of wanted to get an understanding of the general sediment dynamics in this location. As I said, there's DDT contamination, so we kind of were interested in understanding that underlying problem. So this is a much more applied problem. But
what's the name of the lake?
I'm not supposed to tell you for sensitive reasons. Okay, gotcha. So I'm just calling it a large alpine lake. Okay. There's a weird period right now, so I apologize. What? Oh, sorry, DDT is a pesticide, so it's used to be manufactured in the 70s almost everywhere, and now it's been banned, but it's a very persistent pollutant, so it stays regardless of where it goes, and it tends to absorb onto sediments, so it tends to be a very persistent problem. So this, what we were talking about has been introduced, you know, over 33 decades ago, and it's still sort of a prevalent problem, so we're interested in studying sediment transport. All right, so to get an idea, to show you how wrong models can be. When my advisor and I first sort of looked at this problem, we were thinking that sediment transport or sediment resuspension due to internal waves was going to be a dominant source of sediment movement in this system. And when we went out and measured things, there was almost no sediment or no internal waves. So sort of shifted it to look focus on river inflows. My PhD thesis sort of shift focus quite significantly. But the moorings that we deployed looked something like this. So we had on this far left, I guess, we had a thermistor chain that measured temperature throughout the vertical. For reference, this site up here is about 60 meters deep. This is about 120 meters and about 115 meters. So this spanned the whole vertical water column. And then here we had a frame that housed a variety of instruments measuring velocities. So we had two downward-looking ADVs that measured close to the bed. So this is acoustic Doppler velocimeters. These measure basically high temporal accuracy and resolution velocities, so we can get an idea of turbulence near the bottom boundary at a single point. And we have these staggered in height, so we have two different measurements in the vertical. And then this is an ADCP, acoustic Doppler current profiler, and it operates in a similar manner, except for we get basically velocity outputs in a profile in the vertical, so it gives us bins of velocity. And so to get sediment concentrations, the principle of operation of these instruments is they send out an acoustic ping. It's probably familiar to most of you, but they send out an acoustic ping, and particulates in the water column then scatter that signal, that acoustic signal. And so some of that signal is scattered back towards the instrument, but basically the way they get a velocity is that particles moving along that beam shift the frequency of the signal, and the instrument receives a modified frequency signal, which you can use Doppler shift theory to get a velocity. And then you have multiple beams, and so you rotate it to perhaps north, east, and up. For our purposes, this is important because basically, if you have more particles in the water column, namely sediments, you'll have a bigger backscattered intensity signal. And so we're basically using the backscatter intensity as a proxy for sediment concentration. So if we have a higher backscatter intensity, we expect that there's a higher sediment concentration. Now, there's an inherent sort of error and bias with this, is that if you have a larger particle, you also would see a bigger backscatter intensity. So there's some wiggle room, but the general trends are still, I think, reasonable. So again, this is sort of qualitative. We're not saying this much sediment's deposited. We're saying more sediment happens in this location than in this location. So with the ADCPs, there's an added complication of when you try to look at sediment concentrations, that the signal naturally attenuates with depth. So the acoustic intensity near the ADCP is going to be much stronger always than the acoustic signal far away from the ADCP, just because of transmission losses and the depth of distance away from the receiver. All right, so I'll talk about that a little bit more, but just some pictures first. This is pictures of our deployment. Pictures of deployment. So this is our frame, which had ADVs down here. This is about 30 and 60 centimeters above the bottom. And then our ADCP measuring upwards of the water column. So this frame's about here on me, so it's pretty big. This is lowering it down. So we had a big crane that lifted it up and lowered it into the water. Quite an ordeal. And then this is dropping. These are the thermistors right here. You can kind of see being lowered down after the fact.
What's the height of the ADVs with respect to the bottom?
So this is 30 and 60 centimeters at the bottom. So this is some more pictures of the retrieval, bringing the frames up. It was much colder. In fact, it snowed while we were out one day, since we were going in December rather than October. So just some background on the forcing of the lake. So this is the whole year. So this gray box indicates our deployment period, and this is the whole year of 2012. So this is just wind speed, which doesn't tell you a whole lot. More importantly for us is the river stage. So we have basically big spring snowmelt events that happen in May and June, and then some large storms that drive river inflows in the fall. So unfortunately, we just missed a really big inflow, but we captured a couple of other ones. This was the third biggest in magnitude throughout the year. And then as you can see, as mentioned before, the air temperature varies significantly over the course of the year. So we have below freezing at some places and then 35 degrees C at other places. So it's a big range of temperatures, which make it an interesting place because the stratification in the lake changes significantly over the course of the year. All right. What? Sorry, stage is basically, so it's a height of the river, but then you use a curve, a radiance curve to transfer that into a flow rate, basically. So it corresponds to flow, which just doesn't have the right units for flow rate. Okay, so I mentioned the ADCP has a problem of the attenuation with depth. So to sort of ignore that. We just looked at the depth averaged backscatter intensity to just get an idea of how that signal varies over the deployment period. And we correlated that with the river inflow, the basically the flow rate, the volume flow, for each of the three sites. And so we had really good correlations between the two for this site up here and this site down here, but almost no correlation for this site up here, which maybe isn't that surprising. But there's also a nice lag. So the site close to the river outlet is only about an hour behind. So we have a peak in sediment concentration about an hour behind the peak in flow rate. And then the site down here in the south is about 8 hours behind, so it's another additional lag. So it's sort of consistent with river coming in, passing by this first site, and then past the second site, where the river brings in most of the sediment to the system.
What's the scale on that?
On what?
The spatial scale on the map.
Oh, this is about 5 kilometers across. right, so we have a strong correlation between the depth average sediment concentration, basically, and river inflow, which sort of indicates that the river is the dominant source of sediment to our system. And so we tried to account for the depth variability, attenuation of the ADCP to look at the depth variability of sediment concentration. And so this is where I'm hoping for a lot of feedback. But this is basically the raw ADCP signal. So this is time along the bottom and then meters above the bottom. So, meters above the bottom on the left. So this is basically a color plot. These are backscatter intensity units, so they're not really meaningful right now, but you can think of them as sort of a proxy for sediment concentration. But you see there's this background trend of always having higher values near the bottom and smaller near the top. And so one of the advantages of our system is that there's very episodic. So we have these big inflows and then relatively really quiet periods with very low flows, not much going on at all.
What's SSC?
Suspended sediment concentration. Sorry, different audiences. All right. So we tried to take advantage of the fact that we had really quiet periods in our system. So there's a few ways to try to calibrate your ADCP for attenuation with depth. Lots of them include knowing the particle size and diameter a priori. So that's not really an option for us because we don't know what's in our water column. We want to measure it. But you can also, if you have sort of a measurement in relatively clean water, you can sort of subtract that out from your signal, and it'll give you what's the signal due to sediment concentration. And so we sort of use the idea that we have these really quiet periods as our background, basically, attenuation of the ADCP. So this is actually a relatively new technique. I haven't found anyone that does this, so hopefully I'll get some critiques on it. But basically, we subtracted out our large events and used that background signal where we're not seeing very much. And then basically low-pass filtered that to subtract that out. So we get basically a background trend of the attenuation in relatively clear water to get what our sediment concentrations are as a function of depth. All right. So if we do that, we get something that looks more like this. And so we can see during these quiet periods, we have not much going on in terms of sediment concentration, which is what we sort of enforced. But then we have these events where we have different structure to our sediment concentration profiles, where it's not necessarily a peak at the bottom, and it might be a peak in the middle here. So if we sort of zoom into one of those events, I'm going to zoom into this event here. We can look at some profiles of velocity and backscatter. So this top plot is, again, meters above the bottom, and this is velocity, meters per second, of basically past this site along the bay. So this is rotated to be in this direction. And basically, so this is every couple of hours I'm outputting data. And so we basically have a nice peak that shows an intrusion coming through at about 35 meters above the bottom. So right, it's sort of consistent with our initial picture of an inflow coming through and intruding into the middle of the water column mid-depth. And then it sort of varies throughout because we have a variable signal, but it gets a little bit deeper later on. This bottom panel is the same meters above the bottom and the same time, but this is showing the modified backscatter. So this is, again, a proxy for sediment concentration. It doesn't have sediment concentration units, but the shape of the profile should resemble real concentration profiles. And what we notice here is that the peak in these profiles is much deeper. So it's sort of consistent with sediment settling and throughout the propagation of this current. So it comes out and it's continually settling, and that peak is much lower in the water column.
Excuse me, is the backscatter still in J.C. Bell's? Or have you converted it to a different unit?
It's still in the same units, yeah.
Okay.
So much. But it's just, the shape should be the same, right? Just the values of those will be different.
Well, there are some formulas about how you account for the attenuation with distance, and
yeah.
I'm not sure if it's like a linear.
Well, so that's what I did in this previous slide, right? So that was, there's a lot of different equations to do that, but it
yeah.
requires knowing a lot of things about what you're measuring through, like the particle
like
size
that.
And concentration. Like so it's not linear, but we use basically these quiet periods to assume that that was sort of the background attenuation in clear water, just
yeah.
to convert it over to,
okay.
if that makes sense. All right, so these are pretty nice profiles in my idea, in my point of view. So we can also look at the whole time series. Basically, we decompose that into a series of eigenmodes. So this is the first eigenvector, so basically the whole time series. And again, we see the similar shape with the peak somewhere about 50 meters above the bottom. This is distinctly different than something you would see for like a case where resuspension was dominant, right? Maybe a tidal system where you have continual resuspension of sediment, and you expect to see the peak down to the bottom and then decay away from the sediment surface. So this is, I think, fairly interesting. And so this mode contains 80% of the total variance of the system. We can look at also the amplitude time series. So basically, this is the signal that modifies this eigenmode, right, throughout the time. So it can basically increase or flip directions, but the same shape. And you notice it compares really well with our river inflow data. So the peaks in this amplitude time series correspond with peaks in our river inflow very nicely, and it correlates pretty well. So this again sort of suggests the same kind of thing. We have a river intrusion coming through that's depositing sediment, and this is contributing to the largest source of sediment in our system. And the shape, I think, is relatively interesting as well. All right. So we also did, in addition to the ACP, we also looked at some of the ADV data. So this is the point measurement of velocity and sort of turbulence, basically, near the bottom boundary. And so the way we did this, so there's a general sort of, I guess, well-established at this point, relationship between basically the acoustic intensity of the signal and the sediment concentration. If you fit two sort of parameters. And this is often done by taking sediment samples to relate backscatter intensity to the direct sediment measurements you make. We sort of did this after the fact because it's sort of hard to take sediment samples at 60 meters depth. But basically, we had two grab samples in different parts of the bay. And then it had some fixed volume of water where we were continuously measuring at the same settings as we did in the field. And then incrementally added a known amount of sediment to that bucket. So we could say we have a sort of known sediment concentration in theory that we could correlate to our measured backscatter intensity as we were recording. And so you'll probably all figure out all the things that are wrong with this, but we were basically continuously stirring to hopefully give us an idea of a relatively consistent sediment concentration. And then we can fit, you know, a couple of curves, which you can believe or not. But so some of the interesting things about these curves is that, in general, the slope of the curve, so the relation between the acoustic intensity and the sediment concentration, is largely a function of the sediment sample. So for a given sediment sample, the slope is relatively constant-ish, which is probably a function mostly of particle size or content, or organic content, or a variety of different things that contribute to the properties of the sediment itself. Whereas this constant C2, the offset, is largely a function of the particular ADV that we use. So each ADV has a particular, you know, noise background level. So that sort of gives us a little bit of a jump here. So we did this for all the ADVs and all of the sediment samples we had. And the benefit of this, so of the ADVs, is that you can sort of get a sediment flux because you have instantaneous measurements of velocities and sediment at high temporal resolution, so you can get an idea of, you know, C prime, W prime bar, or sediment flux near the bottom. All right, so this is a look at our river inflow event, that same event that I showed you before. So the top is the flow rate, and these three panels I'm showing you are data from the 82 ADVs near the bottom at this site here. So the top panel is just velocity at the bottom. This is sediment concentration using that equation I just showed you in the fits that we established. And then this is, there's a bar here. This is the sediment flux, C prime, W prime bar. I think one of the interesting things here is that it's actually negative. We actually have a negative flux of sediment downward. And I think this is a function of the fact that we have a concentration gradient that's it's higher in the upper parts of the water column and decreases down to the bed. So our, a perturbation in that velocity would mean a higher concentration be moving down to a lower concentration value. So that C prime W prime bar is actually negative. And we see the same thing at this site down here, just everything's sort of smaller in magnitude. Velocity again, sediment concentration, and another negative downward sediment flux. But the timing's a little shifted, right? So it's again consistent. This happens a little bit later than these peaks. But yeah, as far as I know, I don't think many people have measured a negative sediment flux in the field. So I think this is a fairly interesting result in itself. And I check my signs a lot.
What does that mean, a negative sediment flux?
So I think basically.
Draw
something. So if you have, and sort of a, you probably can't see that at all. Let me go up here.
Yeah, better.
So you have some concentration profile. Typically it looks something like this, right? C is a function of Z. And so if we have, we're looking at C prime W prime bar, right? So this perturbation of the concentration, the perturbation of the velocity. So if we have some particle here that we move upward with some upward velocity, so here W prime is greater than zero, this concentration of this particle at this location, so C prime, the perturbation of that concentration is greater than zero, right? So we would get an upward flux. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So whereas in our case, we have something where the profile looks like this.
Yeah.
And so I think that same perturbation means we have C prime less than zero, right?
So it's turbulence is dispersing the sediment downward.
Downward, right. That's my interpretation of it.
So. Are you giving the turbulence and the settling velocity in W prime?
No. But there should be, right, turbulent fluctuations and then also particles settling out, I think, in addition to that. So I think it's an added effect rather than a canceling effect, as in the case of most sort of turbulent systems.
Presumably, do you know how stable is the temperature in the lake?
It's pretty stable.
Can you map out three-dimensional temperature field and understand, because the intrusion flow could be stable and then become convectively unstable.
You mean
if the temperature gradients change in the part of the lake?
Like across the surface? Yeah, we're looking at that. So it's pretty stable, but the wind is an effect, right? So we can have set up or set down of that thermocline, basically. So it can move, but in general the velocities, it takes a long time for that to set up. It's not a very quick process. So and generally these inflows are the dominant, they're like order of magnitude larger than anything we see in terms of the fluctuations, but that's something I want to look into actually. So,
much of a thermal stratification that late in the year?
Yeah, we do. It's almost always stratified. I think it's only mixed like four times in the last like 60 years, so it's almost always stratified.
Yeah, because I know in November, in Ontario, after about October, most of the lakes.
Yeah, most lakes actually do mix a lot, but this one stays stratified always.
Have you looked into the possibility that there might be double diffusive?
I have not yet, but I would like to. Because an idea, right? Because temperature diffuses even faster, so
right,
it might even
right.
be an exaggerated effect potentially. Right. Yeah, that would be interesting to look at. All right, so we did some numerical modeling as well. Numerical modeling as well, sort of to validate what we were thinking from the observations. And so we used a hydrodynamic SunTANS, which is a hydrodynamic model developed at Stanford. That's basically a three-dimensional Navier-Stokes solver. And it uses Meliomonitor 2.5 turbulence closure model to start out resolving turbulence. And then we have relatively dilute flows, less than a gram per liter, often much less than that. So we're basically sort of assuming the things that Eckert Myberg said for dilute flows for our model. Basically, the sediment modifies the density, but doesn't have any there's no particle interactions, and it doesn't have any inertia associated with it. So we just have some prescribed settling velocity that's added into our momentum equations. So we validated fairly well, at least qualitatively, the velocities in our system to match what we were measuring. So this is just sort of an extrapolation to different cases. So as I mentioned, the thermal stratification might be important. So we have two different cases here. The event that we measured was November 25th, the red line here, so sort of in the middle. And we tried to look at two different extreme events where we have spring. This is a typical spring stratification in lakes nearby. And then this is probably closer to a fall stratification. So this is much warmer at the surface. And so this is what I'm showing you is a simulation of the same two, the exact same river inflow conditions. We just have different initial temperature stratification in the bay. And so in the spring case, the intrusion ends up much deeper, and the sediment remains relatively contained in the main part of the lake. Whereas in the fall, we have a much shallower intrusion, and it ends up propagating outside of the bay even. So my description for this basically is that in this case, we're mixing the dense, cold river inflow water is mixing with relatively warmer surface waters, and so it changes the density more significantly, where in this case, it's mixing with much colder water, and so the density isn't changing very significantly. And so the idea is try to look at this a little bit more and try to figure out maps of deposition and how these change with temperature structure. So this is the spring case where, again, the sediment's relatively contained in this area. And then in the fall case where it's a much shallower intrusion, we have propagation of sediment up onto these very shallow areas. And as you notice, it also hugs the right boundary due to rotation. We even have this little sort of pinch off there. So lots of interesting effects to figure out. All right, so sort of general summary of what we observed from our field experiments. We did see one pretty large wind event that, as you're mentioning, modified the thermocline pretty significantly, and it was, won't have time to get to it, but in general, there was not much resuspension as we originally thought. It was really mostly dominated by river inflows, and so river inflows tend to dominate sediment transport and, ooh, I put the name of the bay.
Yeah.
You guys didn't see that. okay. But we expect that rotational and seasonal. Okay. So, but in general, rotation will affect the trajectory of this of the river inflow, and we also expect seasonal stratification to affect, the eventual fate of all these contaminants and sediments. All right. So this is still very much a work in progress, and so I'm right now working on much more of the sort of more intensive validation of my model, namely for like sediment concentrations, since we've only looked at the velocity structure at this point. We also plan to do some more field work. Now that we know that the river inflows are the dominant source of sediment transport, we're gonna focus more heavily on the transition from the river to the bay, which I think is really where all the interesting dynamics occur. So the idea is to put out some more moorings that are sort of in these areas so we can actually look at the transition as it's occurring. In addition, we hope to put out some more instruments beyond just acoustic instruments to get, again, maybe direct water samples to calibrate our instruments or different types of instruments like optical, backscatter, and maybe even a list if we're lucky. And the other point is we want to sort of look at different seasons. So the spring snowmelt where the temperature structure is significantly different. We also have large flows. So that's what's coming up. And then after that, take any questions.
This is fascinating work. I noted that in your temperature profiles, they were all pretty much stable. Were you able to see inversions that would lead to churning and?
No, so we actually had our temperature measurements were measuring pretty quickly. It was, I think, somewhere like about a second resolution, and we didn't see any overturns. It was all very stable.
Actually, would there be seasons where you would expect
you
that
could.
To happen? Maybe
generally, the big overturns are mostly associated with complete mixing. So generally, when you have those massive overturns, you get complete mixing of the water column. And so we're typically stably stratified most of the time.
Yeah,
so I think in a different regime.
How about the wind? Did you ever?
Yes, we had wind.
So there was no, was the level of the lake?
Yeah, it did. So we had, actually we had an interesting event. Sorry, I don't have time to get to you. But basically, in something like this in our bay, we had winds forcing the sort of response in the middle. So if you have a wind pushing down this direction, it piles up down here, and you have this thermocline pull up. And so this is actually where we had an interesting event where you had a large movement of this thermocline past our mooring. And so I didn't talk about that too much, but you can see like And this is our temperature structure, so isotherms, so it's a pretty big movement. But this was an extreme event, which I think had some sort of resonance in it somehow, which I haven't quite figured out how that happened. It's pretty massive.
Yes. I've done lots of measurements on similar lakes in Canada. We should talk about that afterwards. But I was wondering about the ABCP data. You know, what you showed looked like was averaged over a long period of time.
Yes.
You have the raw data to look at. How often was it sampling? 5 seconds?
It was 10 seconds.
Okay.
And we averaged that was averaged over an hour.
Because what we found, and we can talk about this, is that the flow is very, very unsteady. You only have a relatively continuous inflow. Do you notice any of that, or if you look at it at that scale?
Yeah, you can see definitely lots of variability. So I mean, that profile changed pretty significantly at quicker scales. But it was still, you know, a nice shape to it. It was just in the middle of the water column, which is sort of the magnitude and the it was a lot of variability. We couldn't quite reproduce in our model, which I think, you know, you do a variety of reasons.
Okay.
If you look at the topography of the lake bed, is there a scour? Is there much erosional feature?
It's kind of looks like a delta. It kind of looks like it's being depositional.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's not much.
And so all of the sediment that's coming in is really coming into the lake. There's no real mobilization.
That's what we observe. Yeah, that's what it seems to be the case. At least it's a dominant process for sure. There's smaller effects, but.
Yes.
I was wondering, it looked like you had your intrusion was perhaps 20 meters deep when it was spreading out about the level of the thermocline. How does that compare to the depth at the plunge point where the river drops down?
That's a good question. I don't have data from that because we haven't measured that close. I look at the model, but that's sort of how much you trust the...
I was just wondering if you're visualizing it, there's a really thick gravity current going down that's then intruding, or...
That's kind of what we think is happening, but I mean, we kind of want to measure that more directly because everything I say about it will be sort of a speculation, I think.
Yeah.
We sort of have the end result of the intrusion, so I'm not totally sure. But so I hope to look at
one. Somebody else. Just to follow up on that question. Gravity current is relatively thick, but the inflow is probably only a few meters.
It's about 10 meters.
The river is that deep. Okay, so this did not spread all that much then.
It doesn't look like it, but again, this is sort of speculation from simulations, not from direct measurements.
A question about the EDV, I think it was, that you're talking about. Getting the sediment concentration and the fluid velocity.
Yeah.
The scattering of the sound is coming from particles, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you separate the fluid properties from the sediment properties? Or do you assume the velocity of the sediment and the fluid is the same?
Yeah, that's the assumption of the instrument, basically. The instrument is, I mean, to calculate velocities, it's not actually measuring. If there's clear water, it measures no velocity. So it inherently assumes that the particles moving with the flow. That's how it actually measures velocity.
When you calculate something like C prime W prime, could we say then that the W is the sediment velocity? Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah,
probably. Well, but that small.
Yeah. So
hydrodynamic.
I think that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like the inherent assumption with the instrument itself is that it's measuring, it's assuming that you have like very small particulates that are scattering and they're moving with the flow.
The second question about C prime, W prime, what are the time scales of the,
so it's,
you know, the dominant time scales of the variations?
So it's averaged over a 6 minute burst, basically, that C prime later bar. But we have, plus 1 second resolution. So, I mean, with the dominant sort of the frequency of the. Sorry, I'm not.
What's the typical timescale variation of C and W that defines the recurve? I mean, it's a spectrum, I'm sure, but what's the sort of timescale of what they're
doing? I looked at it a long time, so I can't explore it right now. I should get back to you.
we started using BDBs to measure fluctuations. We kind of did some worrying about the filtering of the signal. And I'm wondering, what sort of filter do you use? And you have to, this is kind of a serious question, but what do you do to filter sort of similarly the signal for the concentration?
Yeah, so I actually followed a previous paper to do that. They did like basically tests in electrolyte. The core of Orion is for ABB, right? So, which doesn't be right now, I'm using the name right now, but they sort of looked at some of the concentrations and that fluctuation component. So, you have to sort of do some averaging and some filtering of the signal to get something that's realistic for CPRIM. Otherwise, they're going to be worse first.
Right.
It's the same thing as ABB. So,
but is your concentration signal for the CPRIM, W prime coming from the ABB?
Yeah. So, we sort of just follow the I think there's still like a lot of room to work on that too. It's a little bit of a
marathon,
I think, to figure it out. Right, exactly. Yes. I was wondering whether you can use your instruments to get Doppler profiles, not just the Doppler velocity at different distances from the ground, so that you could perhaps use this to see how the fast components will be from large particles and small velocities from small particles at velocities.
You mean like in like a profile in the vertical, or in a profile with particle size?
You want a variety of different velocities at one altitude.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would be a convolution for both of the. Of the turbulent velocity fluctuation on one side, but also due to the different particle size.
Yeah, so it doesn't distinguish between particle size at all. It just gives you, it reads in basically a frequency based on, it waits a certain time to listen, right? And then it just records some frequency shift, and that can be velocity. So
basically,
no,
you're taking the peak of the instrument,
yeah,
takes the peak.
Yeah,
of
you
the
want to take
spectrum.
Like the spectrum of it, which maybe is in there internally somewhere. I don't. I'm not sure how broad that peak is or not. Imagine
maybe it does not store it because there is a lot of data.
Yeah, it might not. It definitely ran into memory issues, so it probably doesn't.
Yes.
I'm interested in what results in the neutral buoyancy level of the intrusion being at the level that it is. Is it mainly a temperature effect with the river inflow, or is it due to the density contribution of the particles?
So the density of the inflow is about half due to temperature and half due to cycle concentration.
Okay.
The density initially, at least. So the combination of things that happen to get to that intrusion, right? You're mixing with ambient water and then also potentially settling or erosion of particles as well at the change of density. So it's
Do those properties of the river change seasonally significantly?
Yes. But we don't really have that much data on it.
Yes.
Just for interest, is there an analogy here with kind of volcanic intrusions, for example, in the atmosphere?
Yeah, there is. It's a lot of similar research, right? You have.
Yes.
So there's some that intrudes at some depth in the atmosphere. Yeah, so some very similar, I think.
And some combination of buoyancy from fluid and from the particle.
Exactly, yeah. It's a very similar thing.
Another question, comment is that again, I'll show you later. But what we found was our turbidity current came down, and then it seemed to split. So part of it seemed to go where the thermocline was in the lake, and part of it seemed to carry on. So it was at one point both an interflow and an underflow.
Yeah, so there's a lot of experiments on that stuff too. I think it's been observed kind of a lot. So I think that'd be interesting to look at in more detail. Because it's definitely a distinct difference in temperature.
But you might have to have a really high concentration current with.
Yeah.
Sand and silver plate going simultaneously. I don't know if you've got that. So.
Yeah. We could add different components of different basic particle fractions, but we haven't yet. That would be an issue.
We've got a little time if you wanted to share anything else.
Any videos? Better than the kills.
I only had that one. I only had that one. I can talk a little bit more on the other event that we observed. Okay. Care about that. So I mentioned we observed some elevated shear stress at the bottom. This is in October. And so the top panel here is showing wind speed. And this is our isotherms, the function of depth. And so we have sort of a big response here. Most of the time it's very, very flat. So this is a pretty huge response. This is shifting, 20 meters. And then we can also see this is the rental stress taken from those ADVs. So we have a large peak as this isotherm intersects the bottom boundary, which I'll get to a little bit more. And then we can also get them at flux. These are sort of much noisier. I don't really trust these values, but there's a little bit of a peak here. And then a slight peak inside the concentration. This is nothing near the peak that we saw from river inflows. So sort of an explanation for what's going on here, we tried modeling this to look at a little bit more in detail. And so we forced our model with a wind, sort of smooth the wind signal. And the reason for that is because our Met station is sort of tucked up in these mountains up here. And so we're sort of assuming the actual wind speed over the lake is a little bit more smooth. So we smooth our wind signal and filtered a little bit. And we see the sort of similar response of our thermocline. So this is isotherm, where it cuts off at the boundary. And at that same point, we have an elevation in our bottom shear stress. So it seems like that passage of the isotherms past our bottom boundary is what's creating an elevation in our shear stress. So just to show that in a more schematic way, basically in this first, we have sort of basically a stable structure thermocline, sort of a simplified case of warm on top of cold in a separating thermocline. We have some wind pushing the surface water to the right. It causes this lower body to move to the left, right, pulling up this thermocline here. And we actually saw it almost surface up here, some of these parts of the surface. This is what I'm showing this slice here. And then as the wind relaxes, it actually even reverses in our case. So it goes the other direction, it pushes all this body this direction, and this basically falls back down. The sort of supporting mechanism is gone. And so at this point, we actually have the case where our thermocline goes past the bottom of the moraine. So we're measuring about here, right, our ADVs and the shear stress. And so when this thermocline passes by our moraine, so we see the elevation in shear stress. And then it again, of course, stabilizes again. So
is that motion one of the reasons why the temperature is so warm at the bottom?
It's pretty cold, 6 degrees.
But I mean, it's we'd expect it if it was static at 4 degrees Celsius.
Oh, yeah.
And you didn't show anything below 6. So
yeah, I'm sure that's part of it. I'm not an expert on this temperature. There's a lot more complicated things that go on in terms of temperature structure.
But there is maybe geothermal coming from the bottom?
Well, possibly. But, you can have so the shallow waters tend to cool faster, which can propagate down, or, that's, I think, a pretty active body of research trying to understand the structure and how it varies. All right, that's the end of what I have.
Do you see a peak in the suspended sediment also corresponding to the
peak? Yeah. Yeah, it's a little peak. Mm-hmm. But you squint. This is pretty small.
That makes sense.
A little thing. But it's more than order of magnitude smaller than our peak from the river inflow events. But it could be more important in shallower areas, right? Because that should be more active all the time in the shallow regions of the lake. All right. I think I've used my time on.
Okay. Do you ever see a bimodal sediment fines like was mentioned before?
It's pretty much, well, I mean, yes, there is, like, it's a real system, so there's silt in the clays. Typically it's mostly pretty fine in the end of the day. So I haven't seen like the peak, basically the peak or the profile change in anything, but I'm sure there's an effect of multiple grain sizes in there.
Good. Well, let's thank the speaker. I'm especially eager to introduce the next
microphone
speaker.
Oh, sorry.
I'm especially eager to introduce the next speaker.
quickly because while I still have a voice, the next speaker is Brendan Hall from IMG Physical, and he will tell us about particle-laden flows into nature, sediment transport, and unconventional reservoir stimulation. So we're moving from the liquid world to the solid world.